Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, she made me feel like a god. That's when it got wheels off. Zach Williams of the band The Lone Bellow joins Wheels Off from his home in Nashville. There is a fun drama during the course of this conversation involving a cat. You'll have to listen to hear it unfold. He's got a story that, if you don't know it, you'll, I think, be surprised by it, maybe even riveted by it. It's a really fascinating route that he took into music, into songwriting. And it's interesting to see where he is now, seven albums in, four kids later, you know, a move from Park Slope to Nashville. It's a fascinating creative life that he is in the midst of leading. And I think he appreciates his luck, his good fortune in getting to live the life. That's the impression I get. I'm really grateful that he was willing to join me on Wheels Off, and I think that there's a lot of really useful stuff in this conversation, a lot of really inspiring advice. I, for one, know that there's a book that gets mentioned in here that I'm going to go read. And I continue to be so grateful that Wheels Off brings people like Zach Williams into my life. Please welcome to Wheels Off The Lone Bellow's Zach Williams. Welcome to Wheels Off, Zach Williams. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yes, hello. Thanks for having me.
For the edification of our listeners, from where are you logging in?
I'm in East Nashville. Nice. At the bottom of a tree waiting for my cat to climb down.
I love it. I can hear the bird singing too.
Yeah. Yeah. All the animals are begging for her to come down from the tree.
That's good. I thought even in East Nashville, the birds are trying to get a deal.
Yeah, I know, right? This place is hilarious. Where are you?
I live in the Hudson Valley, so I'm about 90 minutes north of Manhattan.
Yeah.
I'm down in my basement office, but I've got a window and it's a really beautiful kind of cloudy, cool day. And I've got the windows opened up here too. You might hear birds on my end.
Dude, that's where I want to live, up there sometime. I've got good buddies in Kingston.
Yep.
I love Kingston. And I've got buddies and just outside the Woodstock area. And yeah. I just love it up there, man.
Yeah, we wound up here 20 years ago in August, and it's been so great. Like, I didn't realize that this was like the secret jewel of North America.
You got Bette Midler up there with you. She's up there somewhere.
See, Rhett Miller and Bette Midler. It's going to be very confusing.
are you from the Northeast?
No, God, no. I'm a seventh generation Texan. How come you're interviewing me?
Whoa.
Zach.
Well, I always find it interesting when people don't live in Nashville that do music.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, I lived in Brooklyn for a decade, mm-hmm. and it's kind of like where I cut my teeth. But then by the time, you know, we were in tour buses and stuff and everybody had families, we had this meeting with our agent and he was like, hey, here's how much more you could be home if you were based out of Nashville. And we all like brokenhearted left New York and moved down here. So whenever I meet someone that like doesn't live in Nashville, I'm like, how'd you do it?
It's a lot of driving to LaGuardia for like okay. 2.5 hour drive to LaGuardia. But I get it. I have tons of friends that moved down to Nashville as well. And the logistics of it seem great. But I kind of had to get out of the South, heat, politics, all that kind of stuff. And this really wound up being a great place to raise kids.
That's but, cool.
Well, if you ever want to come house hunt, I know some good real estate people and I've got a guest room. So you're welcome anytime. Although you do have a big brood.
There's a lot of us. You know, it's funny. My buddy Josh just sent me a house listing. It's this insane. It looks kind of like an old firehouse, but it's 4 hours north of New York, and it's for $100,000, and it has a bowling alley in the basement.
Wow!
And all of the old it's an old Masonic home. And all the old furniture comes with it. And he was like, it's only 4 hours north of New York. And I was like, well, you know, depending on what town it's in, it can get really sad. It 4 hours is a long way.
Or like even Hudson, a lot of Brooklynites move to Hudson, New York. But even that's like 2.5 hours. And to me, like 90 minutes is great. And I've got 3 acres. I'm in the. I don't know how you got me going on this, Zach, but I highly recommend it. I don't want to let the secret out, but this is a pretty great area. Hey,
so
congrats.
You're in the Hudson Valley. You don't live in Hudson. Okay.
Yeah. Got it. Congrats on the new record. I mean, newish record. It's been out for a little while now.
Thanks, man.
Are you, do you have a creative project that you're working on at the moment? And if so, how does it light you up?
Man. Yeah. You know, I started doing more long form writing about a year ago. Like, I don't know if I think just for my creative process, I think I wanted to try to tell some stories that like didn't have to fit in a 3 minute window. And I've been enjoying that. I've been kind of writing stories about my family in Georgia, where I grew up. I had like 6 aunts and uncles, and I grew up close to this place called the Dixie Speedway. It was like an old dirt. So I like, you know, fell asleep to the sounds of the race cars every Friday night, and all my uncles like were like pit crew, and it was like a redneck oasis. And so I've been like gently writing about that for about a year. But song wise, I don't know. I'm currently in a little bit of a funk, I think. I did a solo record and then I immediately did another Lone Bello record. And I feel like my heart was just like, now stop. And so I've taken a little bit of a break on songwriting, which for a season was like really nice. I was like, oh, this is great. I'm only going to write a song if I want to. I'm never writing a song because I have to ever again. And now for the past like 6 months, I've had this like a little bit of anxiety built up around it a little bit. And I overthink songwriting a lot. Whereas like my bandmate, like Brian, he'll go write a song with his next door neighbor this morning. Like he's like very fluid. But anyways, yes, I'm creatively currently in like I'm kind of like a cat stuck up in a tree.
Which is what the scene that you're watching from your front porch, has that developed at all?
No.
Okay.
No, we got food at the bottom of the tree and she's meowing up there. So you would think she's stuck, but she's not. She's not stuck. She has all her claws and she can literally walk up and down the trunk.
I think that's so exciting, by the way, about fiction, about writing long form fiction. And it's a dream of mine. And I know a handful of singer-songwriters that have the dream of swerving out of their lane into that lane. I remember years ago working with Robin Hitchcock and his dad, the British eccentric singer-songwriter who also lived in Nashville for a while, Robin Hitchcock. And his dad had been a mystery novelist. And Robin, at the time, had stopped down from music and was trying to write a mystery novel. And I asked him how it was going. And he said, "You will never write more songs than when you're trying to write a novel." So his experience was that he would get frustrated with this other discipline and he would go back to the thing that was easy for him. So maybe the songwriting will come as you lean into the fiction.
I love that. That's encouraging. That whole time I thought that you were about to drop that his dad was Alfred Hitchcock. I was like, wait, mystery. What?
No, that would have been good.
Man, no, that would be great. That would be great.
Do you have aspirations to carve out some like short stories and publish them independently? I'm sure people would freak out.
I'm in this situation right now where the stories that I'm writing are true and it would royally piss off my family members.
Like, it's like David Sedaris style true story.
Yeah, maybe so. But David Sedaris, you know, I feel like the majority of his family have great sense of humor. It's not saying that my family doesn't have a great sense of humor, but like Amy Sedaris, like, I love that story. I forgot which book it is, but when he talks about how he visited her in New York one time and she showed up and like one of her back molars were completely missing. And she was like, can you tell? Is it obvious? And he was like, yes, I can fit my thumb in your, in the gap of your tooth. The stories that I'm working on, it's like, a lot of crime happened that was like never taken care of. No, Goldie's still up in the tree. Yeah. They're inside. First week of summer, all four kids are home. I could change all their names, but their names are so perfect. Like, it's hard to change their names. It's like my Uncle Dale, and then my aunts are Tammy and India and Narda. It's like, you can't. My grandma did so well naming her daughters, like, weird Southern Gothic names. Like, I don't know. It's hard to beat. So right now, the way I'm writing, I just, like, have their names in there. But, yeah. I don't know.
When you were a kid, do you remember wanting to be a musician? Did you think you might want to be a writer? Was there like an epiphany moment? Was this always in your consciousness?
So not when I was a kid. I started writing out of like a, writing was like a cathartic thing for me. So my wife and I got married young, like small town, right? We got married when I think I was 22. We got married way too soon, but we made it through. But a year into being married, my wife fell off one of my family's horses and broke her neck and was like a quadriplegic and was diagnosed quadriplegic, which, you know, that means you can't move from the neck down. We're at this beautiful hospital called the Shepherd Center down in Atlanta, Georgia. And I was, you know, grief and shock and all of it, you know, the human heart just kind of goes numb, you know, and just like, I think it goes into some sort of like emotional survival mode. So I personally was having this like kind of outer body experience where I was like worried about myself. And I was going through these classes, like trying to figure out how to like, they were teaching me like how to bathe her and feed her and da da da. And my friends would come up and visit me in the hospital and they'd be like, how are you? And instead of trying to communicate how I was, because it was so layered and I didn't understand it, I would just like read them journal entries that I would write like in the middle of the night. Like, and thankfully they were all like kind of curved towards artistry. They were like thespians and wanted to be playwrights. And they were like, hey, you should try to learn how to play the guitar and sing at the same time and just go sing these journal entries at an open mic. And I miss open mics, by the way. Yeah. Open mics were they were so great. I found an open mic almost directly across the street from the hospital. It was at a coffee shop, and the songs didn't have any choruses or anything, and I would just go, and like that's where like I finally like cried for the first time, you know, because like when you're going through shock, like, sometimes like you don't, you know, like some I remember when my buddy's dad passed away at a really young age. He was like, why didn't I cry at the funeral? I was like, well, you know, sometimes it just doesn't happen like that. Or a buddy like had his first kid and was like, why didn't I cry when I held the kid the first time? It's like, well, you know, so anyway, so the first time I cried was like in front of strangers. Mm-hmm. And that's where songwriting became like a really just exciting and safe place for me to kind of like explore my own feelings. And thankfully, like beyond the doctor's understandings, like Stacy, my wife, completely healed and walked out of the hospital. It was insane. But while we were living in the hospital, this is like 04. Me and all my buddies like made a pact. We were like, hey, if Stacy ever can like move again, I think we even said from the waist down, we were like, let's all move to New York City together and just like pursue the arts. So she got better and we all did. All 10 of us all wow. moved up and it was so fun. And we all just like were dirt broke back when you could be dirt broke in Brooklyn and get by.
Yeah.
For a long time. And yeah, man, that was kind of my journey into songwriting.
Wow. And does it still serve that same therapeutic, cathartic purpose for you?
It does, for sure. It's like twofold now, and you probably experienced this too, but like at shows, like in the same moment, you like remembering like why you wrote the song, right? And you're singing it. And at the same time, you're like, I know this song isn't mine anymore. It's like these strangers in this room, and you get to be a part of somebody else's like deep breath. And that, I mean, that's like the honor of being a songwriter and trying to do this right. Like it's just like being a part of this like human kind of thing. So that's a very beautiful cathartic thing for me. And then also, yeah, writing, I went through a phase where I thought that I could only write like sad songs out of tragedy. I remember this one time I was living in Brooklyn. I was playing at Rockwood Music Hall a lot. I don't know if you've ever been to Rockwood.
Of course.
Yes, of course. All right. So Ken Rockwood was like my mentor. the guy that owned Rockwood Music Hall, he like totally took me under his wing for years. He had his own record label with Atlantic Records, and he wanted to sign me. This is before the Lone Bellow. And we went to Legacy Studios, and we went to Avatar. These two, like, do you remember these places?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And you know, we like live recorded a few songs, and he took it to his boss man, this man named Pete Gambark. I'll never forget his name. Pete was like high up at Atlantic, right? And Ken was like, hey, Pete wants you to come in. He wants to meet you, you know? And this is back when like getting a record deal would like change the course of your career. Right.
Yeah.
So I was like really excited, and I showed up. I forgot my capo. he's like, sing me a song. I'm not a good guitar player. I was like, sang him a couple songs, like in the wrong key. Totally flopped. And he said to me, he was like, hey, I don't want to have to wait for another tragedy to happen to you for you to write like another good song. And I was like, what? And that was the end of that meeting. And I think I kind of carried that fear with me for a long time. And then I don't know, like years later, I was playing Newport Folk Festival, and I met my hero, Jim James, from My Morning Jacket. And he was such a nice guy. He like took me out for coffee, and I had this whole talk with him. Like, hey, I feel like I can only write out a tragedy. And he was just like, hard stop. He was like, it's definitely harder writing out of a place of like emotional health and even joy, but like, you should do it and you can do it. And for the past like 4 or 5 years now, I've been trying to do that, and trying to put myself in other people's stories. And you know how it is, like you get in a chapter of your life where like things aren't as crazy as they used to be. Like, you know, my wife and I's relationship isn't on the brink of falling apart anymore. We like have built like a strong foundation with each other, and we're raising children, and we have other people's hearts and minds like on our mind, you know. So that's kind of, I know that's a long answer to your question, but that's kind of where I'm at right now, of just like, how do I write a song when I can pay my bills. I'm not broke in New York anymore. And anyway, you know how it is.
Dude, I think about it all the time. The old 97's going to the studio next week in Portland with Tucker Martin, who did a bunch of Jim James, My Morning Jacket stuff. But
which Portland?
Oh, Oregon with Tucker Martin.
Oh, yes.
Produced. So anyway, but I'm writing a bunch of new songs, and I'm 52 years old, and I'm thinking like, you know, the conversations I have with my friends are no longer about terrible life choices and drunkenness,
yes,
and the kind of right? things that I wrote songs about for years. And now it's about, oh yeah, you know, my hip is really hurting. I had to get an MRI on my hip. And I'm like, is this what I have to write songs about now? It's not my hip, but still, it's like, yeah, I think Jim is right. I don't think we have to write. Well, that it's part of why I think so many artists wind up with drug problems, because they think that they have to be in this really messed up space to make great art. But yeah, that's, I don't think that's true.
It can't be true. It can't be true. No. I've really enjoyed. Oh, she's coming down. Yes. Harlan.
Gracie.
Hazel. Give her space.
Gracie is coming down out of the tree.
Here, Goldie. Yeah. Goldie Hawn.
Oh, Goldie.
She's out.
Goldie.
And Hazel has her. We've got the cat.
Oh, woo! I was hoping we would get a happy ending for the listeners.
Bring the kitty to me. I've got to show my new friend here. This is Goldie Hawn. Goldie. We named her specifically after the Overboard movie.
Yeah.
Oh, where her and Kurt Russell fell in love.
So she's a troublemaker. Oh my God. Look at that cat. Goldie is not gold. Goldie is black and silver and beautiful.
Take her inside. Looks like shut the door.
15 job, pounds of girls. Fur. Nice.
Congratulations. Where's the dog? The dog's fine.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
Yeah, that's great. Anyway.
So, yeah, mental health, songwriting. But okay, so let me just ask you this. We all artist types, and probably everyone, but specifically artist types, run into these interior obstacles, these self-generated internal obstacles. And I wonder for you, what have you figured out as a way to work through those, you know, self-generated obstacles?
You know, I want to start with something that triggers those. Mm-hmm. And I want to know if you share this. Venues across America have all of our, they're like, sign the wall.
Yeah.
Right. And you look at the wall and there's like 300 band names that you've never recognized. You're like, I have this like thing where I'm like, where are they now? And is this going to happen to me? And like, we're like 12 years deep into like touring full time. And I still have this, like, what's going to happen? Is there something that I don't know about? I can safely say I don't have a good tool for this. This is something that I battle on the regular. But I'm down to battle it. I wish I had something where I was just like, yep, whenever I feel that resistance, I grab this wand and I'm good. I have vocabulary to it now, especially that, you know, there's that book, War of Art. And I felt like that guy did such a great job just talking about like the constant resistance. And he talks about how like everything, if we could have a perspective where like everything in our lives and in our world like doesn't want us to create. It wants us to like numb out. And I'm not even talking about like the internet and social media and da da da. I'm talking about like the grind. Just like bills, worry about the future, ADHD, whatever you want. Like him putting that vocabulary to what I wrestle with, like on a daily basis was really helpful to me. But yeah, like you're going into the studio next week, like, how are you feeling? And how many records deep is this for you guys?
This will be the 13th Old 97s album.
Wow.
And then I've also made 8 solo albums.
Whoa.
And then a couple of albums of weird stuff early on. So what, there'll be like 20, this will be like the 24th album.
Man, that's amazing.
And I started thinking like 10, 15 years ago, is this enough? Like, when will it be enough? Like, does the universe need more songs from me? But I need more songs because my kids are going to go to college this year. And yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. So how do I feel? It depends what day you ask me. Like, I was down in Texas a couple of days ago and I played through the A-list for my mom and my brother, which is sort of a tradition. You know, whenever I got new songs, I'll play them for those guys. And
really?
Yeah, and they're great. They're a great audience. They don't say too much, but I always feel like they appreciate it. And it usually I come away from it feeling better about the A-list. And then I came home, came straight from LaGuardia to my mother-in-law's birthday party, and it was the in-laws, and they were like, you know, play a couple of new songs for us. And they didn't want more than a couple. And then I played them and they sort of talked through them. And I just sitting there thinking, these songs suck. I suck. This record is going to suck. Yeah. It's hard. It's hard. Yeah. You know what? I feel like I should read The War on Art. I got to read The War on Art. That's good.
War of Art. It's War like of art. That thin. It's just it's like,
okay.
It's, you could listen to it on the way to LaGuardia.
Yeah.
One trip up. Man, I can't believe that blows my mind that you play embryonic songs for your family. That's really interesting to me. I'm such a nervous Nancy.
Yeah.
Like, walk me through this. Like, what time of the day is it? Like, what does everybody have in their hand? Are people sitting down? Is it inside or outside? Like, what's the vibe usually like when you do this?
So, you know, my mom is a loner, and she's always been super supportive of my music. And she was a singer, and she dreamt of being like a backup singer to the Stars. Kind of, she's got a great voice, but she's always been pretty good at listening to my songs and not making me feel like they were broken or I was broken or whatever. And my brother Ross is great at that too, but those are about the only two people in my world that don't mess it up. Like anybody else, I'll play a song for them and they can almost say nothing right.
Dude, your in-laws? No way.
I don't know why I said yes. I shouldn't have said yes.
It's insane.
It was a bad idea.
I mean, that's an SNL skit in my mind. a writer who's about to go into a record and is really nervous about these songs that he's written sits down. For me, it would be like two very type A, very busy people. Just like, oh man, that would be insane. I want to try this now. I could not. I mean, they're lovely people.
But you're so raw. When you write a song, you're so raw, dude, right?
Dude, yeah. Yeah. It's hard because you don't want to be identified by, I always try not to find my like human identity in my work. I'm always like, I want to be a good friend. I want to try to be a good listener. That's my like measure of success, right? And I mean, I screw up all the time, but like that's the deal. But like when I'm reading, even just reading a thing that I read someone out loud, like I have like this whole existential crisis. It's like I'm like flipping over and over in my head thinking about it. So, but you saying that definitely makes me think, like, who would I do that to? Who would I sing in front of? Especially in like an extended period of time. I've done like one song in front of people, but to sit down and like have an evening of like, here's my list, here's my A's. I've never done that before. I love that. Now I've done that like in a concert to strangers. That's no problem, right? But like right in front of one other human that you know really cares about you. That's hard.
Does a thing happen to you where a song that you just wrote versus a song that's been out in the world and on an album and people know it. And like you described earlier, it's become their song in a way as well. Those songs, the pre-existing longtime songs that are out mm-hmm. in the world, those have their own life and their own gravitas, and they seem like they've always existed. But this new unvetted song that nobody's ever heard or loved or hated or whatever, like I kept telling myself, if this song gets recorded and it's on an album and it goes out in the world, I'll love it. But right now, yeah. I don't. They're different. It's a different thing.
Yeah, I know. It kind of, and you second guess. I wonder too, if I'm like 7 records deep. But I know what you're saying. But like, you know that back before I had like easy access to recording music, that was just how those songs lived for like months or even years. The song only existed if I sang it in front of my friends. And that was a powerful thing. And now it's really easy for me to walk across the street to my neighbor's backyard studio and like suddenly give a song gravitas at all. And I wonder if it's a little too much cushion. I think I want to do this, man. I think I need that thin layer back. I got too much armor.
I will tell you this. A thing happened while I was playing the songs through where I would realize, oh, this pre-chorus, this is way too precious. It needs to move quicker. Or, you know, this bit in the chorus that I keep convincing myself is fine. It's not fine. Like, it's not even like they tell me it's not fine, but hearing it through their ears as I'm singing it to them, it's a totally different experience. And you remember that, what you're describing back when those early songs used to only exist in performance. I'm sure as you played them, they would hone themselves you know, in sort of like water running over rocks or whatever, like the bad shit would erode away and they would get better as they were played. God, I wonder if we should go back to that, Zach, playing songs.
I think we should. I mean, you know, the other hard thing about leaving New York, my closest friends are there. I mean, I have friends here, and we actually had a lot of friends move down from New York to Nashville after we left. But like the two people that I think of where I'm like, this is who I would want to like sit down with for an hour and a half. And like they're both up in New York. But it makes me want to fly up there and do it.
So, I know you got 4 kids, but you don't have to lean into your dad mode for this necessarily. I'm wondering if you would mind trying to distill some of this wisdom you've been sharing by imagining a 21-year-old version of yourself.
Yeah.
But in today's world, 21-year-old you, what advice might you give yourself?
Oh, man. It's funny, my 14-year-old's about to go into high school.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's like a cliff she's about to jump off of kind of thing. So 21-year-old me now, right? Yeah. And this, okay. I feel like the art of conversation is really important. And being able to listen, I think is really important. I would definitely try to challenge that person to make that like top priority. especially in this time right now where like everyone's there's so much drama, you know, online and this and that. I would be like, hey, meet with your friends face to face and have at length conversations with them. Yeah, I think listening would be the first, like, do this for me kind of thing.
It's funny you've brought that up now a couple of times, the idea of listening. This must be something that you're thinking a lot about. This is a big part of your journey at the moment.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. I think I'm really worried. I think if I unpacked it, I'm, you know, we just had this thing happen in Nashville a few months ago. We had this like shooting at a school, and it was awful. And thanks, babe. Wow,
nice.
I got a new cup now. And even a few years ago, like, while, Donald Trump was president, like I had a thing that I would do where like someone would attack, like, for instance, I'll just narrow it down to one story. Like, we had someone opening for us and she had a Not My Press shirt on. And a fan of ours who didn't feel the same way that she felt politically started attacking her personally online.
Mm.
So I reached out to him and I was like, hey, here's my number. Give me a call. And I've done this. I had done this multiple times, and I would get somebody on the phone and we would have like a human conversation, and it would be great. Like, suddenly we weren't avatars online anymore. We were human beings talking on the phone. Dude, after this shooting happened, one of the family members of the kids that she hadn't even gone to the funeral yet. We were talking about going to the protests and we were inviting everybody to go to the like gun control protests with us, which like where you live is like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
Down here, it's different, right? Someone started attacking this lady online. I did the same thing. I reached out to him and I was like, hey, give me a call. I didn't even say like, hey, this person that you're attacking is grieving. She hasn't even gone to the little girl's funeral yet. I was like, just give me a call. And I got him on the phone and I learned my lesson, and I don't know if I'll ever do it again. He yelled at me for 15 minutes straight. And I waited for him to calm down. I listened to everything and I was like, hey, I'm not even calling you to talk to you about your beliefs in the Second Amendment or anything. I just wanted you to hear a human say, like, the person you're attacking is grieving right now, and don't do that. Just give her space. And he was like, I don't believe you. And I was like, okay, we have lost the ability to listen to each other. This is too much. So I wonder if I'm like quietly really moved by that and worried about that. And then that boils all the way down to like your people in your house, right? Like, can my people listen? Are we the type of person that can have a conversation with someone who doesn't agree with us about something? I think that's so important, right?
Yeah.
And you would think that that's like common sense. I don't think it's common sense anymore. And that, so maybe that's why it's like right there.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It really lands with me. I had a moment with my 19-year-old son yesterday, who's this deeply spiritual kid. And we were kind of going back and forth because he's a teenager and it's sometimes it can be rough. And I said, what do you want me to do? And he said, just listen more. And I was like, you know what? He's right. And I don't know if it's it's a human trait that it's hard that we want to yell and scream and say what we think rather than listen. I do think there's a lead singer-itis, you know, where we always have the microphone and we're used to being listened to. But yeah, so I'm definitely aware of that and trying to get better in that regard. So it's funny that you would make that such a point of emphasis today.
It's so hard. Same exact thing happened. I woke up this morning and my 12-year-old who has the, like, in a good way, in a bad way, has the mind of like a 25-year-old. Like, her little brother, like opened the door of her room at like 6 a.m. It's the first week of summer. I wake up to screaming and I like wander in there. I'm like, stop, just don't scream. Everyone stop screaming. What's going on? And I just wanted to fix it. I just wanted no one to scream. And she said, will you just listen to what's happening for a second? I was like exhausted. I was like, no, yes. Okay. Yes. I will. But man, we just want to fix stuff without listening.
If they would just listen to us, Zach, we could fix everything.
Yeah, we could have so much more fun.
Oh man, speaking of which, this has been really fun. Thank you. I feel like there's so much useful stuff in here. And I know, like, I might have taken you into the weeds a little bit, talking about new songs versus, you know, songs that are out in the world. That's something that's really on my brain. I appreciate you humoring me in that. And I can't wait to read the long form fiction, and no pressure. I know that stuff can take a while. I know in my dreams of writing long form fiction are long-term dreams. So yeah, this has been really great. I really appreciate it.
Dude, well, good luck with the new record. I'm excited that you're doing it over there. Have you made a record on the West Coast before?
You know, I've made a record in Portland before. I made a solo record with Chris Funk from Decemberists out in Portland. I love that city. I've got a lot of friends in Portland. You know, we've got Pete Buck from REM is threatening to come in and play some mandolin on the album. And
holy cow,
it's a great vibe. And I think this is a great time of year to be out there. So I'm excited about that.
Man, it's going to be great.
I'll let you know how it goes. I know there will be some Jim James vibes in that studio too. So I'll try and soak that up.
Dude, well, man, I went to, let me say one more thing about James. I went to his solo tour. It was the first one with AEIOU on it. And I thought he was doing this thing on purpose with his stage presence. He was at the Ryman. He was stiff as a board, which, you know, usually at his shows, he's like, he was stiff as a board. And I was like, oh, this is like a character that he's doing. This is interesting. And people would like reach their hand out to touch him. And he would just like, ET phone home, like just touched their finger while he was singing. And I was like, that's so rad. This is so powerful. I love it. Da, 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 da. And then a couple months later, I saw him in LA and I was like, man, I love your thing. Da, da, da. It turned out that he had just like thrown his back out that morning.
Oh,
and that was the whole thing. And I was like, well, dude, keep doing that because it was really, really cool.
And there's a lesson in there as well, I feel like, because it's so tempting for artists when you get hurt or you're sick, you have a cold, to get out on stage and go, man, I've really got a bad cold, or I threw my back out. Don't. They don't need to know that. Just go do the show.
I know. I always think about Dave Grohl.
Breaking his back and coming
breaking,
back.
Breaking his femur or
his
something.
Leg. Yeah, his leg. Oh.
Dude, this is insane. Anyway, man, good luck.
So
thank
great.
You for the talk.
Thank you, Zach. All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.